From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mercurimi was suspended last month on official misconduct charges after he was convicted of a domestic violence-related crime involving his wife. Mercurimi joins us in the studio in his first extended broadcast interview since the incident. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A warrant for Ross Mercurimi's arrest was issued 5 days after he was sworn in as sheriff of San Francisco, resulting from an incident which occurred with his wife, Eliana Lopez, during a heated argument the couple had on New Year's Eve. A bruise on her arm was shown by Ms. Lopez to her neighbor, Ivory Madison, who in turn called the police. Mercurimi, who worked on behalf of victims of domestic abuse while a San Francisco supervisor, was charged with 3 misdemeanors and, under a plea agreement, pled guilty to a lesser charge of false imprisonment. He was sentenced on March 19th to 3 years probation and other penalties. 2 days later, Mayor Ed Lee, the mayor of San Francisco, suspended him without pay. He is now in the process of challenging that suspension and possible dismissal from the job he was elected to on a charge of official misconduct in a suit slated to be heard in Superior Court on April 20th. Under the city charter, he is entitled to a hearing on official misconduct charges before the city's Ethics Commission, which would then make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors. 9 votes of the 11 supervisors are required to remove him from office, and the Ethics Commission is expected to begin its hearings on the 23rd of April, barring any change as a result of the judge's ruling this week. This opening Forum Hour, we hear from Ross Mercurimi in his first extended broadcast interview since the New Year's Eve incident, which set all of this furor into motion. Welcome, Ross Mercurimi.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael.
Well, let's begin by talking about what you would have said to Mayor Lee, because there are kind of conflicting stories here. You went in to see the mayor, and you said you wanted to tell your story to him. He says that you didn't really that he gave you opportunity to tell the story. In other words, there's a he said in this. What's the story you would have told the mayor? What's the story that you want people to know?
Well, I absolutely appreciate this opportunity to be here with you. This has been quite a nightmare, an ordeal, and the story that I would have told Mayor Ed Lee on more than one occasion, which I had offered, is a story that, frankly, has been eating at me for nearly 4 months that I haven't been able to tell. Quite frankly, I've relived the story thousands of times in my head. I believe that my silence, and until recently, my wife's silence, she had an op-ed published in the Chronicle on April 6, had allowed the story to be narrated by a lot of innuendo and rumor and distortion in some ways that really became a branding. I mean, when I entered the office the second and last time with Ed Lee, there was very little preliminary discussion except just seconds where Mayor Lee simply told me that he has offered me an ultimatum of either resign or be suspended. The meeting, frankly, would have ended right there if I did not ask him how he arrived at that decision and again offering him the details of a story of what happened and also offering him the phone number of my wife so he can have an independent account by talking with her, since I have not seen Eliana, had contact with her since January 13th. I thought that
you were prohibited under court.
I am. Yeah. And that's been excruciating. But for the mayor and anyone else who's rendering a decision of this magnitude, I certainly had hoped he had taken me up on the offer. And what this is about is that I made a terrible mistake on December 31st. It was at 11:45 a.m., not in the evening, but during the day, we were on our way to lunch from our house in our van. In fact, we were on our way to Delfina's Pizza at California and Fillmore, where they don't take reservations. And a horrible quarrel had started between my wife, Eliana, and I. It was a somewhat familiar subject about an impending trip that she was going to take to Venezuela. She had taken one 6 months earlier, where she and my son, Theo, had been away out of the country for over 2 months. That was excruciating to be apart from my family, and we agreed that there would be a plan because my wife, who hadn't had her green card yet at that time, there had been some immigration issues, and my insistence that there be at least an agreement and a plan. And in the car on the way to lunch, we began to argue about that, where I was seriously misrepresented when I heard somewhere somebody said that I said I was powerful and you can't take my son away. That was a complete distortion. What I had been quoting was California law and how strong our laws are in California about parental rights. And that escalated in the discussion. So what I did was turn our car around, our minivan, Dodge minivan, turned it around against my wife's wishes. So I decided not to go to lunch because I didn't want us to be arguing in public about a very sensitive subject like that, and turned the car home, which incidentally, that is the basis for the plea that I
false imprisonment.
False imprisonment. It's on the fact that I turned the car around.
It sounds very innocuous, of course, as opposed to what false imprisonment sounds
like. Well, I'll leave the interpretation to anybody, but you're right. I mean, the false imprisonment analysis that I've been hearing from people has just been, you know, it's just been excruciating to hear what people have been saying. And the rest of the story goes is when I parked our car, I had already vented what I had to say, and so it was off my chest, and I acted inappropriately. I swore at my wife in front of my son. I was angry that she wasn't hearing me, and I regret this terribly. But she was also extremely upset to a point where I had never seen her agitated before. In a way where it made my son extremely upset. So as she was getting out of her passenger seat and to unharness our son, who is nearly three, he was panicked. You could see the panic, and she was screaming. And I reached over from the driver's seat, still with my seatbelt on, to put my hand underneath her arm to try to guide her back into the passenger seat so we could just de-escalate this and talk this through. It was that when I put my hand under her arm where she had then got bruised in that process. I was instinctively just inserting myself because I saw my wife upset in a way that I hadn't seen her upset. My son was just... I thought I was being a father in a moment where I had not any premeditated thought, and I thought I was trying to remedy the situation. She then, of course, goes into our house. There had been no incident outside, as what news reports had indicated. And when I just tried to decompress for a moment or two in the car, took my seatbelt off, locked the car up, and proceeded to go in the house. The door was locked. I knocked on the door. Ileana, with our son, opens the door, unlocks it, opens the door. And the day, although strained, there was also no, sequestering of my wife. She came and went as she pleased. There was no argument inside the house. There was nothing outside the house. The characterization that she was in essence kind of imprisoned in any kind of way is complete false. There was stops to the grocery store or going to a local falafel restaurant for her, for me, alternating care of Theo that day and on the next day as well. And she decided on the next morning to go see our neighbor. What she had informed me of, which was part of the quarrel in the car on the late morning of December 31st, is that she had been seeing an attorney. And when I thought our conversation was about extended stay in Venezuela, what I realized, not until the next morning, that this was potentially a custody issue, because it just hit me in a thunderstruck, almost in an ambush kind of way, is why is my wife seeing an attorney? And I had no idea who that attorney was.
What a frightful irony that now she is in Venezuela and she's extended her stay in Venezuela, although, as you said, she printed or published an article really talking about her love. It was a love letter to you and
it was a love letter, and it's the best thing I've received since January 13th. But you have to understand, her stay in Venezuela is something that I fully support, because to be suspended without pay, to try to break a person so that they can't provide for their family.
Was her father ill too, though?
He has cancer, and I want them to be protected. And that also goes to part of the elements as to why I was so concerned in stressing my concern to her during the argument. She's high profile in her own right in Venezuela, in Caracas. I had just been elected sheriff. There had been some very high profile stories of kidnappings of Americans in Venezuela and of other people. I've been in Caracas and in Venezuela a few times. I see what security conditions are like for people in middle class or even above. I felt that we were being laxed in not having a conversation about her taking trips to Venezuela and not thinking through the kind of, well, maybe it's paranoid, maybe not, but I was doing what I thought was the right thing.
But the bruise, of course, became the center of focus here, and it became a center of focus in large part because a former girlfriend came forward and said that you were rough with her, and that exacerbated things, and so did your statement, which you have apologized for and which you also said was really taken out of context, about this being a private family matter.
Well, I never said it was a private family matter, and there were so many distortions early on that became the branding. And I have to say, I mean, you and I have talked on this program before, on air as well as off, and I've never really been that shy to the media. But the tsunami that had hit me and my family before I was even charged was just so overwhelming that I frankly just kind of shut down. It was a wipeout.
And you were ashamed too.
I'm incredibly ashamed. I still am. I'm trying to muster the energy to tell the story, but that's why I'm here, is because I owe the people an explanation. I've been a public servant 7 years, proudly, of an incredible organ of government in the Board of Supervisors, one of the greatest districts, I think, in District 5. It was a great relationship that we had. And then I was elected sheriff, much to the surprise of many, when I was outspent by one of my chief rivals by more than 2-1, and that we won. So I owe it. And that's what's been eating at me, is that while silently and privately and through the mechanics of dealing with the legal and now political administrative process, I'm finally sort of mustering that reserve to tell the story that hasn't been told.
Let me ask you, though, I want to get back to the ex-girlfriend. I know you have something perhaps to say about that that might clarify, because there were two ex-girlfriends. One came forward and said he was a good guy and gentle, and another—
In fact, that was from Evelyn Nieves, where we were in a relationship for 7 years. And she, who I hadn't even talked to in a while, offered that herself, which was published in the New York Times Bay Citizen, but it was never, ever captured in the local press.
No, what was captured was a woman who came up from Los Angeles to testify.
Which I was looking forward in the trial to really dispel. I thought it was a piling on. There was so much fabrication that had come up, and this piling on, that in itself made me that much more motivated to looking forward to the trial, because this piling on became so, it felt so insurmountable, but I had no choice but to look forward to a process to either validate or to demystify what the truth was. And quite frankly, allegations like that are things I take very serious.
Your wife said, this is the second time this is happening, and I tell Ross I want to work on this marriage. We need help. This is in the video that was released. Both, you feel at this point, wanting to move forward and, well, make this marriage work.
My wife has been a champion both here and abroad, 5,000 miles away in Venezuela, in wanting to repair and rebuild our relationship. And, you know, I thank God and I thank the heavens that every night when I go to bed and pray to be a better man and wake up in the morning to hope to aspire to that change, that is what motivates me, because I believe that through an experience like this, to go through an ordeal like this, to be turned inside out for public dissection in the court of public opinion, that I can only hope that I either just completely evaporate as a person or just better myself as a father, as a man, as a husband, as a sheriff.
It's all about restorative justice in many ways, I suppose, is what you've been saying kind of implicitly all along, which you've been a strong advocate of. But what does your wife mean when she says this is the second time this has happened?
No incident like this has ever happened before. She is referring to a quarrel that has been familiar and intense verbally about the extended trips to Venezuela. There had been three, and it's a personal matter where I failed in, I think, the last trip that she had taken to not go to counseling, when we both agreed that counseling was the right way to sort through, I think, our misunderstandings and differences.
She kind of said in the article that you were not all that willing to go to counseling. You were caught up in the rush of electioneering for sheriff.
And, true. Yeah. I procrastinated. I didn't put the priorities of my marriage, my family, in a way that I should have. And that culminated, I think, into what became an avoidable situation on December 31st. But that's true. And to be honest with you, as soon as this happened, before I was even charged, I immediately had sought a therapist, hoping and not knowing that I was going to be charged, that we could begin couples counseling, because the flag obviously was a 2x4 across, you know, my forehead. And yet, even though we've tried unsuccessfully through the district attorney and the courts to go to couples counseling during this ordeal where we had been rejected, I decided to use that therapist myself to go over some of these issues, issues I referred to in my statement and my apology after I made after my plea.
You've also been doing anger management, haven't you?
Well, it's part of that.
Yeah. But, and has that been helpful?
It's humbling, incredibly humbling. It's humbling to be part of a larger caucus of men of all different ages. Many who had committed very severe offenses and not so severe, to be part of that is incredibly humbling. And I have to tell you, this provides a very rare perspective, whether I'm part of law enforcement or sheriff or not. It raises a lot of questions, actually, about how effective is our system in dealing with, I think, helping change behavior in a forward-thinking like San Francisco.
We're talking with San Francisco Sheriff Ross Marcorini, who was suspended last month on official misconduct charges. And I'm going to give a phone number now as we come toward the break. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And you are free to call us with any questions or comments you have for Ross Marcorini. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. Your wife says this is a political conspiracy. She said that publicly on a couple of occasions. In fact, she called it a coup d'etat or golpe de estado. I mean, you agree?
My wife is amazingly passionate, and the tonal quality of politics in Venezuela is, and in Caracas is definitely, I think, a bit different. But that's what I love her about. I mean, she said from the second one, from the moment that she discovered on January 4th when the neighbor, without Ileana's consent, had decided to call the police, and my wife panicked in trying to reach me while I was at work at City Hall doing supervisorial duties. And she ran down Grove Street. We live in the Western Addition, Fillmore. Ran down Grove to meet me late in the afternoon outside of City Hall to tell me in person what had happened. I did not know about any of this, about her level of contact with the neighbor. I had no idea about a video. I had no idea about what became a runaway train. And she was so panicked and so scared that she was asking me, telling me, begging me to do something about this because it's a system she's not familiar with. And she felt, I think, from that second that there had been an orchestration. And over the last 4 months, the more we've learned in our own investigation, and I think just in the subpoenaing of documents and everything else, my wife has arrived at a conclusion that it's more than just, I think, the merits
but
of a legal case.
Do you concur or agree with that? Do you say you find out new things that make you inclined to believe that?
Well, do I think that politics is involved? You can't deny it. This morphed from, in some respect, what was at the Hall of Justice into City Hall, now to an administrative process. But as sheriff and as a member of the Board of Supervisors and as a former member of law enforcement working for the district attorney for 9 years, carrying a weapon, graduate of the San Francisco Police Academy, class president, I've always said from second one myself that I have to believe in the system, which is why I would never interfere with the system. Whether I like or dislike what the outcome of the system is, I've held to the point that I have to believe in the system.
Well, let me jump in there for a moment because today there's supposed to be a hearing on a question of whether or not the suspension should be overturned. It's scheduled for Friday, but an initial hearing about whether or not Dennis Herrera, the city attorney, ought to be involved in this. Are you going ahead with that? Because it's my understanding that Dennis Herrera has brought in different counsel for the ethics committee, which would change the whole landscape.
You know, this is just a completely uncharted territory. This has never happened before in San Francisco. And I apologize to San Franciscans, really helping cause, I think, this unprecedented and very painful kind of event. So it is unscripted and frankly, an unknown. So the Ethics Commission, which is which constitutes a panel of five political appointees, the mayor, the board of supervisors, the city attorney, the district attorney, and the assessor recorder each has an appointment in the Ethics Commission. They will hear a case and make a recommendation to the board of supervisors. It does beg question initially that when the city attorney was assigned to guide both Ethics Commission and to represent the mayor against me, where there are and where is that firewall of ethics and what is just and fair. And I'll give you another example. The city attorney has been conducting an investigation. They have the power of subpoena, whereas my attorneys and we do not. So like in the question of in a criminal case in the proceedings of the Hall of Justice, where there is an investigation by the district attorney, where evidence that is collected is made discoverable in this particular case, that has not been the case.
So you're
yet.
Going ahead against the city attorney.
Yes.
Which, for the record, the city attorney says abuse of the judicial process and also cost to transparency and cost to the resources of the court. Let me ask you actually something that's sort of related to this, and that is you mentioned the video. It's the contention of Ivory Madison's husband, who is an attorney, that there was an attempt to destroy evidence. We'll actually come back to that because we're coming up on a break. But this would mean actually theoretically, I believe, criminal charges against your wife if it were proven in court or if it were brought substantively forward. So it's a pretty serious charge that's been made, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. We'll also bring our listeners into this, and we're talking to Ross Mercurimi here with us in studio. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Ross Mercurimi, San Francisco sheriff, suspended presently and former supervisor from District 5. And he was suspended last month on official misconduct charges after he was convicted of a domestic violence-related crime involving his wife. He is with us in studio talking about the incident, talking about really the, he used the word tsunami. That would not necessarily be an inappropriate word. At first it was described as, I think by you, Ross, as a runaway train of innuendo. Now it's become nothing less than a tsunami.
And that was weeks ago, by the way. That was weeks ago. In fact, it was one sort of think tank that had calculated the number of stories that had been reported on me in a six-week period, and that was 302 stories just on the local press compared to, say, another high-profile incident, at least involving one of our former mayors or something else, where the number was compared to 48. So when you deal with that level of fact and our story wasn't being presented, then that obviously sculpts for the public and the court of public opinion a very different, I think, scenario that we had to contend with.
Well, a couple of things that I mentioned that have sculpted this story and made the narrative go a certain way also have to do with the charge of you and your wife apparently trying to convince Ivory Madison and her husband. Her husband made this charge publicly that the evidence should be destroyed.
Yeah, I think that that's a complete fabrication and fiction. I was frankly just blown away that I saw that in an op-ed. And frankly, so were I know Ileana's attorney and as well as my attorney. And frankly, shocked. And I look forward to the process of taking that head on. As a matter of fact, as I think referenced earlier in our conversation, I believe in the process, and I believe that before I was even sworn in as sheriff, when this had erupted and I was informed later in the day on January 4th about the existence of this, I was in such a state of shock. The only thing I could think of was, holy cow, we need, I think, some legal representation. We need an attorney. That was my level of thinking. And I know my wife was panicked because she felt completely betrayed by the woman next door who turned out, in my wife's opinion, that I discovered not until January 1st that this was her attorney.
Not a friend or neighbor she was confiding in. She went to her with the thought in mind that I'm going to an attorney?
Yeah, and this obviously been a developing conversation that more had to do with, which I did not know about.
Because, again, they've said the opposite of this. They've said that she came essentially.
And I'm not surprised considering the fact how this all mushroomed without my wife's consent and in a way that really begs the question of what happened between her initial conversation with the next door neighbor between January 1st and then on January 4th. What happened in those 4 days where there was no call to the authorities, no call to any kind of advocacy organization out of concern or care for my wife or her condition? The characterization that also was wrongly reported that I had whisked my wife away on a trip to Monterey was completely false. We had pre-planned that trip before December 31st. Everybody that was close to me and preparing for our inaugural and everything else knew that we were either going to go to San Diego or go to Monterey. And then what I saw in the report that when we took that trip, my wife and son had never seen the Monterey Bay Aquarium before we went. But yet what we saw reported was that I'm trying to sequester my wife. And, you know, going to trial, we would have been able to show the reservations that had been made and the pre-planning that went to this. But that none of this was accurately reported.
Well, there was an article in The Guardian, which I wanted to cite by Myrna Melgar, who herself was the victim of domestic abuse, who said that your wife was disempowered by her neighbor, by the police, by, the media, even by those who oppose domestic abuse in many ways, because everybody was offering help on no level except prosecuting you. You agree with that assessment?
I do. I absolutely do, because in the very moment of that panic that my wife had exhibited when this all erupted, that I did not know about until sometime later in the day on January 4th, it was clear that she had been betrayed by the neighbor and that she was absolutely scared. I will never forget her running down Grove Street, where she ran many blocks to come see me to tell me what happened. And then it just hit me like a thunderbolt because it was hard for me to fathom just now what was occurring. I've never been on the wrong side of the law. I've never needed an attorney before. I've never, committed a level where that I was being accused of this kind of act. It just
But let me go back, though, with you to this Christina Flores, who said there were three incidents of verbal abuse and a fourth of physical abuse, your former girlfriend, when you allegedly grabbed her arm during an argument. You want to go on record on that?
Sure. I believe it was fabrication and fiction. Do I think that we had an argument of verbal abuse? Yes, I do. I believe that that was well reported about her contention. And then as I and you referenced earlier, a relationship that came to a natural end before I saw Ms. Flores, Christina Marie Flores, was with Evelyn Nieves for 7 years, who took it upon herself to say there had never been any unwelcome contact by me at all. Nobody locally accentuated that. I was looking forward to the trial, looking forward to the emails by Ms. Flores that, in essence, was trying to get across a way of getting even or trying to settle score that also had been reported when those emails were released. And I was looking forward to having that day. But, you know, we put that case behind us and it was moving forward. Nonetheless, I walk away from any one of these experiences, lessons, in having to really self-check myself in making sure that, you know, that nothing like this could ever happen again. So that's, you know, that's an important
takeaway. Almost begins to sound a bit, though, from some perspectives, I suppose, as what your wife had said, that there's some kind of conspiracy, but you have to say, I mean, Ivory Madison fabricating, her husband fabricating, Christina Flores fabricating. But these are people who don't have really political involvement in this at all.
Well, I can't speak to that. And you can deduce or anyone else can deduce what they would like. The coming back to the core of what we're talking about is that I made a terrible mistake and I took responsibility for that as it relates to me and my wife. And I did so with the plea that I did. And that plea, by the way, is for a nonviolent, low-level resolution of a misdemeanor that did not inhibit my ability to be sheriff or possess a weapon. And I entered into that with the express purpose that I would retain my position, of course, only to be confronted by another challenge as instigated by the mayor.
I should also mention to listeners that the challenge that's going forward is based on the fact that the episode occurred before Ross McGarimi assumed office. So the idea legally is that it can't be a basis for a suspension, but also a suspension for misdemeanors being argued does not constitute moral and turpitude and is a denial of due process. There's also a question, I think, about the language of the city charter defining official misconduct and whether that's constitutional. I just want to get all that out there for listeners. I also want to go to some of our listeners. In fact, here's Michael from Oakland who says, if he did not falsely imprison her, why did he plead to it? I'm not buying this emotional minivan driving soccer dad act. That's not the character of a top cop.
Well, that is exactly the facts of what happened, and that's also exactly the facts of what my wife speaks to, too. This isn't a story that's just coming from me. That is part of the 15-minute experience that occurred from when our argument did only occur in our van as we left for lunch and me turning it around. And the plea of a 236 false imprisonment on a nonviolent measure is exactly what characterizes how we arrived at that. I also take responsibility for a bruise that I had caused my wife. So it is part of that whole 15-minute ordeal and nightmare.
Let me read another email from Ron who says, the story Ross tells us is quite different than what has been reported in the press. If Ross's story is true, then the DA and the mayor have been overzealous in their prosecution of Ross. The false imprisonment plea is a joke. What I find also very troubling is the horrible legal representation Ross has received. Why not just come forward earlier and explain your side of the story than hide behind legal maneuvers? This seems more honest, and I think most people would understand. And if Ross and Eliana wish to see each other and work on their marriage, who are we to interfere? I'm sure you'll agree with that last sentiment, but what about his point about why not come forward from the beginning?
I wish I had. I got to tell you, one of the things that really ate at me was this notion that I said domestic violence is a private family matter. I never said that. And that became sort of a branding that just blew me away. And as you said in your opening, as a supervisor and even before as being a supervisor, I'd been an ardent champion, enthusiastic. I mean, people who are elected are allies. I think of the domestic violence advocacy community and making sure domestic violence is extinguished in this city. And I took that to heart as 7 years member of the budget committee, staying very late, at many budget committee meetings, fighting for ad backs. I never ceased to trumpet the needs of the community, especially as chair of public safety. So I wish I had spoke earlier, but I have to tell you, and what I was trying to describe earlier is that as somebody who really had never been that insecure or shy with the press, where I grew at a comfort level to speak to the press, this walloped me to the point where I was just down. And that, on top of the advice of my attorney at the time, and I tend to agree that I think it was a bad decision to not speak to the press. We should have, and I regret that that didn't happen earlier.
When you did come forward and make that apology, though, publicly, and spoke about your shame and spoke about the cost that this has had on you personally, and you said, I'm not the person I thought I was, and this is a dark world now, and admitted that you had anger and arrogance issues, what did you mean by saying, I'm not the person I thought I was?
Oh, my God, I'm destroyed inside out.
You mean you thought you were tougher, or you thought you were more elastic and resilient, or?
No, I thought I was more tender, more caring, not as gruff or abrasive, not as testosterone packed. I think the people understand who I am. I've never been part of any kind of machine per se. I've always been the kind of guy driven by my tenacity and determination. I am by what people call tenacious, and some people also think that that's just a very, maybe overbearing type A.
A euphemistic word for arrogance, perhaps? I mean, here's a web comment, for example, says both Ross and his supporters have suggested and continue to suggest that the sole motive for his persecution is political. What does Ross believe is the main political motive for people's spite toward him? And I think what you're suggesting here is maybe people love you or hate you, and if they hate you, it's maybe because of tenacity, arrogance, and those kind of personal qualities, maybe more than political?
For me, it's a survival strategy, I think, as it related to trying to succeed in politics. I failed as being a member of the Board of Supervisors and trying to cultivate relationships in a way that I think others had made it a priority with other electeds and fellow supervisors. I was there to do a job. I've always believed, and this is a speech I would actually give to staff and interns, talking about that government doesn't work well enough and that it's my determination, our opportunity to show that government can work better for the people.
What would be the political motives of those who you see as, or you surmise may be, your political enemies? Because really, Mike Hengisto gave you a full support and said, we're absolutely allied.
You're talking about Sheriff Mike Hennessy?
Sheriff Hennessy, excuse me.
It's ironic because it was Sheriff Hengisto who was in jail for 5 days.
I'm going back in time here, Ross. Forgive me. No, not Dick Hengisto, who was a sheriff. And actually, was also a sheriff in my hometown, Cleveland. And Mike Hennessy came out and supported you fully and said, we're completely allied politically and we have the same vision of criminal justice.
I mean, because
why would they see you as a political enemy? I mean, that's
I don't think that the embers stopped smoldering after what was, to many who fought valiantly, who fought so hard to support another candidate after the November election. It was a hard-fought race. We had a strong grassroots effort, under-resourced in many ways, and we had to muster the kind of energy that was people-driven. And so others who I think expected a different turnout.
So the political enemies would be those who were defeated?
Well, not necessarily, no. I mean, I can't speak to other people's motivations or what's catalyzed this. Some people, I think, are reacting to just what they read in the press, what they think is the truth, how they may feel about me even before that this happened on December 31st, and others may have drawn different conclusions. So I can't really say that there's a smoking gun right then and there. And that's why when you ask me about the coup d'etat question in itself, everything is bubbled up in such a way where it has been a complete nightmare for me and my family. But does that deter my ability for being an effective sheriff from realizing, I think, the very dream and vision that Sheriff Mike Hennessy tried to put forth for over 30 years? And that is that we are about public safety, but we're about the power of redemption. And that's what the criminal justice system should be about in California.
This is a city, though, that, of course, is known for that, known for its liberal views about criminal justice.
We could do a better job, to be honest with
you. But it's also known for cracking down hard on domestic violence.
As it should, as it completely should, which is why I want to be and continue to be that champion and come from a voice and perspective that I think gives me even greater value in doing so.
All right, let me bring in some callers, and we'll begin, Casey, with you. Good morning.
I am more interested in the point of the state bringing charges against him without his wife, the injured party, bringing the charges. I think it's something that the police do on a regular basis in probably like 75% of the things they prosecute, and I think it's immoral. And I wonder what the sheriff thinks about that after his case.
Well, my wife never did want to bring charges. As a matter of fact, I believe it was the day after, on not January 4th, but January 5th, when an inspector or somebody from the police department had contacted her, asking her if she was okay, if everything was okay. And she took it upon herself to say everything was fine. I never wanted this to happen. She didn't call 911. She told the inspector that she would if she thought that there was any kind of danger. And yet what was reported by the neighbors is diametrically profoundly different than what had been shared between Ileana and the neighbor and what Ileana then told somebody over the phone from law enforcement or on behalf of, you know, a domestic violence advocacy organization.
Actually, I think we have a neighbor of yours on here. Roy, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me on. I think he should try a new career as a fiction writer. He sounds like a pathological liar.
Just based on the severity of that comment, what can I say? And I'm sorry, I'm emotional, but when it comes to you know, my family, my son, the way that they have been leveraged against me, I am emotional about it. It's not easy for me to tell this story. I haven't told it really in 4 months. When my son, who was kept away from me, frankly, I think for no reason, I mean, here's an anecdote for you. When one night when I was staying at Mirard Agnos's house, he and his wife had been amazing to me in allowing me to camp out there for a little bit.
It's former mayor of San Francisco.
Yes, and had been amazing in their support. My wife called out of complete panic that my son had come down into broke out in a complete rash and had respiratory problems and thought that she was going to have to rush him, you know, to the hospital, to Kaiser. My immediate instinct was, I'm out of here. I'm going over there to help them. And I had to be pulled back because of the stay away. It turned out to be, based on the testimony of the daycare provider the next day, that due to the separation of my son and I, my son was manifesting that separation in an allergic reaction. And then finally, when we went to family court, despite the interference of the DA to try to block me from seeing my son, where eventually we won, where I was able to see him for 2 hours a day, all that reaction and that allergy and that rash disappeared completely. And so it was just so painstaking that I'm still living it. And I apologize that if I am sounding emotional and I'm not the tough guy sheriff you want me to be, I don't think there's any other way to tell
you
this.
You have to apologize for being emotional. Let me get another caller on here. Scott, you're on. Hi.
Hello. I just want to tell Mr. Mercurimi, thank you for coming on air and talking about what's going on. You have nothing to apologize about. A real man shows his emotion and is able to do that and still be a man. I just, and that's just a stigma. I just want to tell you that I'm going through the same thing that you're going through about with the courts and custody and all that, and it is extremely excruciating to not be with your family and not be able to see your son and have a stay-away order the way that you have to deal with. And I do feel like your family was sabotaged by the mayor, by the neighbor, and that your wife maybe was emotional when talked to her, and she was just totally betrayed because the lady went and called the newspaper before she even called the police if she had real concern for your wife.
All right, let me thank the caller for that. Here's a listener, though, a woman named Kristen, who says, listening to Mr. Mercurimi has been very triggering to me. I'm in the process of divorcing a man who, to hear tell the story of our marriage sounds eerily like your guest this morning. We, too, had many incidents in the car. He, too, paints me as being out of control and hysterical when he retells the story. It's a common tactic for emotionally and verbally abusive men to start arguments in the car. It's a confined space in which the victim is truly imprisoned. I am struck at the skill at which Mr. Mercurimi subtly shifts blame to his wife while he says he was wrong. All I heard in his retelling of the story is justification for his actions. Sir, placing a hand on your wife's arm does not cause a bruise. Violently trying to restrain someone does. Mr. Mercurimi does not need anger management counseling. Abuse is not an anger problem. Abuse is a problem of entitlement, the sense of entitlement to control the actions of another. Couples counseling does not help in these situations and can often make the situation worse. Couples counseling focuses on communication problems between the couple. Abuse is not a communication problem. Again, it is an entitlement problem, the sense of entitlement to control the actions of the other.
I agree. I completely agree with that. And again, I'm not making any justification. I'm telling exactly the story as it happened. And I think from the stream of where my wife is coming from, it I think, is consistent where she's coming from. And that is an entitlement question that I abused. And I was wrong for that, completely wrong for it. But I also want to explain that there was somebody else in the car. It was my son. And I'm not going to dismiss the fact that I was scared and panicked for him as he was agitated, and so is my wife. So the stew of what happened at that moment in a very short period of time, and mind you, this all lasted 15 minutes from beginning to end in the car and parking or so, is exactly why I did what I did. And I made a mistake, terrible as it is. I cannot say if couples counseling would help or not help. That's a projection, but it's something that...
I think it depends on the couple.
I think it depends on the couple. That's what I mean. And this is something my wife wanted that I failed, to participate in.
Let me ask you what's in your heart now for you. I mean, I know you've made it very clear that you love your wife, but she set all this in motion to some extent by taking the case next door, and she felt justified in doing that because she wanted to protect the custody.
Which issue. I had not known about at the time until this sort of unfolded in the investigation.
Do you resent her, though, I mean, for doing that? I mean, it would be natural and human if you did.
No, I don't. I don't. This is all my responsibility, and I take full accountability for it. She made a tremendous sacrifice coming from Venezuela into a city that is unfamiliar to her, into a lifestyle that was unfamiliar to her. I think expecting her to kind of mold into this kind of relationship where there hadn't been a lot of pre-courting. And so this was, we've been married about 3 years.
How long was the courtship? It was pretty short, as I recall.
It was less than 6 months.
Yeah.
And yet we were absolutely determined to make it work, and celebrating the fact that we were having our first child. We had our child at home as a home birth. So the meaning, the profound meaning of what had occurred at our house is something that we still cherish a great deal. Being part of a process where you have a home birth like that, that's not something you ever forget.
Let me read a web comment that says, this is nothing more than a typical family process of learning how to cope with powerful feelings, which is being exploited by powerful people. I am so sorry to Ross and his family. I cannot imagine having my children taken away from me, and I suspect all the Ross haters share this essential human emotion and would have been just as emotionally charged now and when the minor argument in the family car occurred. Here's a caller, Joanne. Join us. Hi.
Hi, thanks. Your politics a lot, and I'm not sure how I feel about the case, but my feeling is that Ed Lee, who, as an aside, politics I don't care for, but that's really a moot point, kind of had, given everything that was going on and the way it was affecting the city, had no choice but to suspend you, and I wonder your feelings about that. Thanks a lot.
I think it would have been more prudent and professional if Ed Lee had taken me up on my offer to hear my side of the story and to even, with my encouragement, to talk with my wife, Ileana, certainly independent of me, before he had arrived at a decision. So I understand that the mayor has got to do what the mayor has got to do. I don't have any ill will about that. But as it relates to process, as somebody who's a fellow elected on a citywide stage, as somebody who's been part of law enforcement and part of the legislative body of the city, what they've done and how they've done it, in my opinion, is unlawful.
Let me read a few more responses. Here's Tony, who says, I've heard enough. Apology accepted. New Yorkers made a mistake drumming out Elliot Spitzer when he was governor, and Wall Street really needed policing. While Oakland turned its cops against its people, I remember Ross standing with the occupiers to prevent violence. We need someone like him to be sheriff. Another listener, Steve, says, I voted for Sheriff Mark Remy because he promised to continue Sheriff Mike Hennessy's legacy of rehabilitation over retribution. When the news first broke that he was charged with domestic violence, I was heartbroken and wanted to hear from him and not the media what happened. But I understood the criminal justice system, and I know he was being advised not to speak. Thank you for allowing him to tell his side, and thank you, Sheriff Mark Remy, for taking responsibility. Let's move on. That's pretty much your feeling, isn't it?
I cannot tell you what it's been like in this climate of, at least through the press and how people have arrived at certain places. Maybe I'm projecting, maybe I'm not, but that level of social disgrace that just hit me like a 2x4, you know, made me be pretty much scared of my own shadow as I was going out in public. But people would come up to me right and left encouraging me to fight, encouraging me to hang tough, offering well wishes, you know, to me.
Let me say, I have to jump in.
Sure.
Come to the end here. Good luck to you. Thank you for coming forward and being with us this morning.
Thank you for your opportunity. Thank you for your time.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.